ethnic nationalism, religious extremism, conflicts over identity. These features of political life increasingly look like they define the 21st century. In one way or another, identity politics is on the rise around the world. These trends have been more long-standing in societies experiencing intractable conflict. And perhaps the worst-case scenario for the rest of the world is that the conflict zones of today provide an insight into our shared future. This is what we once might have called the balkanization of world politics. Today we ask, what is it about our financialized world order which is driving the lurch to monolithic political identities? As these trends globalize, what can we learn from the experience of conflict-blighted political marketplace societies? And how can we reverse this trend, encouraging greater cooperation and democracy?
Under the current system, it's easy to get dirty.
He is named, he is mentioned by name in these Paradise Papers.
You have the goods, you're king. If you own the mines, if you own the product, you're the boss.
The miners don't work for money. The rocks the soldiers don't steal are traded for food.
Welcome to Conflict Zone from the LSC, with me, Azaria Morgan, and my co-producer, Luke Cooper. Conflict Zone is a new series of podcasts exploring the nature of global conflict in the 21st century. We take a closer look at the causes and drivers of intractable wars. Our team of experts draw on cutting-edge research and big ideas to expose the networks of money and power driving organized violence in the modern world. This series is produced by the Conflict Research Programme, an international research project funded by the Department for International Development.
In episode 2, we introduced the idea of the political marketplace, a concept that refers to a situation where politics becomes a question of buying and selling support. We showed how this can lead to violence between groups that are trying to leverage power and influence in marketplace conditions. In this episode, we look at the relationship between political marketplace societies and identity politics. Groups competing for resources in political marketplace conditions need to construct the basis for their legitimacy. And identity politics can be a useful way of doing so, creating a coalition of supporters that imagine they have the same interests on the basis of a particular identity. Importantly, when we talk about identity politics in this podcast, we are not referring to the pejorative term that is sometimes used by the far right to describe what we could call liberation politics, things like feminism or Black Lives Matter. Instead, we are referring to the use of monolithic, them and us identities, usually based on religion, ethnicity, nationalism, or sectarianism. In this episode, we focus on some key case studies: Ethiopia, Iraq, and Syria. By the end of the podcast, you'll get an insight into how development states can risk sliding back to political marketplace societies, a trend we see in Ethiopia. We'll also outline the relationship between ethnic conflict and economic and political incentives in the conflict sites of Iraq and Syria. We begin with a reminder of how political marketplaces work.
The people lying dead in the road had just finished Friday prayers when a bomb went off outside the mosque.
Iraq's prime minister blamed the sectarian strife on another place in the region.
The protesters' message could not have been clearer. The people want to topple the regime.
Part 1. What is a political marketplace and how does it foster identity politics?
Political marketplace societies have weak levels of institutionalization. This means that rather than the state operating as a public authority, able to rise above the conflict between individuals and regulate them through arbitration of one form or another, the state becomes a site of conflict between rentier factions over resources. Alex DeWaal is research professor at Tufts University and director of the World Peace Foundation. As we discussed in episode 2, he developed the concept of the political marketplace through observation of elite politics in Sudan. He describes the key terms that elites themselves use to describe marketplace politics.
As I began to theorize the political marketplace, the two key terms that the practitioners use themselves are the political budget, which is the money that is available for political spending without having to be accounted for, the money that you can use to buy loyalties, to buy influence, to buy key services like security or law, and the political market, the extent to which loyalty is transacted according to the principles of supply and demand. And where the political marketplace differs from simple corruption or simple deal-making is the price function. In all political systems, there is some transaction that goes on and maybe bribery. But if you cannot see a price function, if you cannot see an organization of that, it's not a political marketplace. It's just a transaction or an act of corruption.
In political marketplaces, not all deal makers have the same value. Some are more experienced operators, and these groups can take advantage of less skilled practitioners to leverage greater support.
Some individuals or some political marketplace firms had more skills than others. And the third characteristic that is used as a sort of diagnostic or an early warning by practitioners is, what are the political networks and skills of the particular practitioners? So if you ask a security officer in one of these countries, you know, what is likely to happen in such and such a country, they will very quickly fasten on to, well, the skills and the networks and the reputation of such and such a political actor are high or low, so that he or she is, and they're almost all men, there are very, very few women in this, so that he is overestimating his price, or he can be bought more cheaply, he is actually underselling himself.
In this rather cynical climate of rentier politics, deal-making and political violence as a mechanism for leveraging power and influence, identity politics can play a key role. Mary Kaldor is Emeritus Professor of Global Governance at the LSE and Director of the Conflict and Civil Society Research Unit. As she explains, this environment is highly conducive to ethnic conflict.
Actually, what we find is the political marketplace and the identity politics tend to go in tandem. If you're competing to get into government as a way to gain access to money, you can't really say that in political terms. You have to frame it in ethnic or religious terms. It works much better than the political marketplace than having a policy aimed at the public good, for example, because if you're going to give all the money to you and your supporters, you're not going to support welfare or other things. And what we see in all our sites is there is this, very often the political marketplace is organized on ethnic or religious basis. Having said that, the logics aren't the same. So they actually tend to contradict each other. The political marketplace is rather a sort of rational type of logic. And identity politics and ethnic politics have a life of their own. They generate passion and hatred that is very difficult to rein in. And so actually, there are all kinds of contradictions that you can observe. And it's those contradictions which make it possible to think about alternative logics.
Part 2. Intercommunal violence and the political marketplace. An analysis of post-war Iraq.
In episode 1, we made the distinction between new and old wars. Old wars are fought to resolve conflicts between states. Contemporary new wars are more like a social condition, an intractable conflict situation. The Iraq War of 2003 was in some ways an attempt to pursue an old war with updated technological capacity, but it became a social condition of war, an intractable conflict situation involving state and non-state actors alike, and with a strong role for identity politics and intercommunal violence. In 2003, it was hailed, however, as one of the swiftest and most decisive military victories.
In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
But within just a few years, it was recognised as an immoral action and extraordinary policy failure. To this day, Iraq, the world and the Middle East live with the consequences. Despite their technological and military superiority, the American administration had failed to understand the changing nature and logics of war.
It's the most sustained period of intense urban fighting since Vietnam.
Dozens of bodies appear on the Capitol streets every morning.
They find the bodies of 21 fighters, terrorists to the Americans, martyrs to those who support their cause.
A key part of the emerging divisions in Iraq concerned identity politics, the religious division between Shia and Sunni Muslims. This in turn fed into a geopolitical conflict in the Middle East, notably between Iran and Saudi Arabia, but with lots of complex divisions and alliances within that context too. In addition, there are long-standing demands of the Kurdish people spread across Iraq, Syria, Iran and Turkey for statehood. Jessica Watkins is a researcher with the Conflict Research Programme and Middle East Centre at the LSE. As she explains, these divisions have an origin within Saddam Hussein's rule in Iraq, but became especially salient after the American War.
Political identity based on differences related to sect hasn't just come out of nowhere in Iraqi politics post-2003. Under Saddam, political positions were allocated on the basis of Ba'ath Party membership. But in practice, even though Iraqi Shia are thought to comprise around 65% of the population, the majority of high-ranking public positions went to Sunnis. At the time, investment in the predominantly Shia provinces was neglected and political expressions of Shia Islamism were repressed. Collectively, they were clearly causes for discontent. But in the run-up to the US-led invasion of Iraq, opposition parties in exile met essentially to bargain over the form that government should take after the Ba'ath regime had been removed. These negotiations were factored in by the coalition provisional authority after regime change, and they really became the basis on which political positions were subsequently allocated. And because these parties in exile identified primarily in terms of sect and ethnicity, so Shia, Sunni and Kurd, they did a lot to ensure that the post-Ba'athist political field would be dominated in the first instance by ethno-sectarian identities.
This is what social and political theorists sometimes refer to as path dependence. Institutions and identities that form through history accumulate power, influence, and organizational resources that give them persistence into the future. They are hard to dislodge or transform.
So the new Iraq has had a sort of consociational political settlement whereby the lion's share of political posts have gone to Shia, and specifically Shia from particular parties. It's not like Lebanon, where there's a formal agreement that the president is Christian, the prime minister is Sunni, and the speaker is Shia. But there is an informal agreement in Iraq that the president will be Kurdish, the prime minister Shia, and the speaker Sunni. And similarly, that the minister of interior should be Shia, and the minister of defense Sunni, and so on. So while the Iraqi government is technically the product of competitive elections, and there have been three national elections since 2003, in practice, the choice of particular posts largely comes down to elite pacts between the most successful parties and blocs in the election. And these parties came to dominate the political field, so even if they didn't really represent the views of Iraqi voters whom they claim to represent, it's become difficult for other parties running on more genuinely issue-based non-sectarian platforms to break into the field.
Because Shia Muslims are the largest grouping, they have come to the fore in the democratic politics of post-conflict Iraq, with the ironic effect that they are often aligned with Iran, a country opposed to US influence.
Over the years, the dominance of Shia political parties has, of course, alienated a lot of Sunnis. Many of them have boycotted the national elections, which has further reduced their political representation. And this sense of marginalisation is widely believed to have contributed to some Sunnis sympathising with militant Sunni Islamist groups, including Al-Qaeda and Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, or Daesh, as Iraqis refer to it.
The rise and fall of ISIS in Syrian and Iraqi politics underlines the complexity of alliances in the Middle East and how they map on to different accounts of identity. The extremist group is opposed to both Shia Iran and, on the other hand, the United States and Saudi Arabia. There is no simple division, but a range of stakeholders with often conflicting interests. These are geopolitical conditions favourable to marketplace activity. Jessica Watkins explains how this has created a problem of corruption and patronage in Iraq.
Iraq has been subject to state capture and complex forms of patronage politics. If you think of a political marketplace as a system of governance in which transactions or deals dominate formal institutions, laws and regulations, and where those in power have to be expert deal makers in order to retain power, then certainly Iraq increasingly seems to fit that description pretty closely. So Iraq's economy, as everyone knows, is heavily dependent on oil. Around 90% of government revenues come from the oil industry. So Iraqi political factions have been competing either directly or indirectly for control over that wealth. But the currency for making political deals isn't normally cash. At the national level, it tends to be access to high-ranking positions that empower the holders to give supporters access to public employment and to state resources that come with that employment. And then at the subnational level, political and security actors compete for positions where they can exploit oil revenues and or access and control territory where they can levy informal local tariffs, for instance, at checkpoints, or take cuts from government contracts.
So we can see how the role of identity politics is critical to the functioning of the political marketplace and vice versa.
Because the most powerful political parties are dominated by sect, and those parties have carved up control over state ministries and state-owned enterprises, they've been able to distribute patronage in form of public sector employment to followers and thus preserve political support groups. And again, at the subnational level, some of the most prominent actors post-ISIL have been the Popular Mobilization Forces, or PMF, that are backed by Iran. The PMF is a predominantly Shia volunteer force, and it was established in 2014 to defeat ISIL. And it was subsequently incorporated into the Iraqi security forces. But in reality, some of the PMF, which receive Iranian backing, continue to act virtually autonomously.
As this has become structural in Iraq, it is important not to disparage ordinary Iraqis for having to engage with this political marketplace system.
The Iraqi political field, it has become one of entrenched corruption. It's become structural to the extent that it's not necessarily helpful to demonise Iraqi citizens who are basically forced to buy into patronage politics to survive. If you think about the social contract that you think you have with the state, in the UK, for instance, even if you're sceptical about the ruling political party at any particular period of time, then you or most people have some level of trust that in return for fair competition over access to employment and for paying taxes, the state will provide certain services in return. But if you have to buy into the imaginary of the state or else the whole system breaks down, and if you don't trust the state can provide or will provide those services, then there's more incentive to work for the benefit of a smaller identity-based group. And it becomes a vicious circle. And that is what is happening in Iraq. I don't think that in the Iraqi case, it's a circle that is so vicious that it can't be escaped. But I certainly think it's become very challenging.
But this isn't the only dynamic in Iraq. Mass protests broke out across the country in 2019 and were repressed with lethal force. These protesters told German television network Der Welle why they were protesting economic injustice and corruption.
We are peaceful demonstrators. Those rulers harm the Iraqi people. No salaries, no appointments, no plot of land. Their promises are lies. And now they're hitting us with tear gas.
There are no job opportunities here. They stay at home without a hope.
The protests are notable for the crucial role played by young people.
The protest movement that started last October has been taking place in the capital, but also in most of the predominantly Shia provinces across Iraq. And it has been a massive popular reaction against sectarian apportionment. Of course, I think we have to recognise that beyond sharing a sense of dissatisfaction with the current government, not all of the protesters share the same goals. But overwhelmingly, the protests have been dominated by young people, and 60% of Iraqis are under 25. And the signs are that the younger generation who grew up after regime change do not support the political process or the agendas of the traditional parties. And that was very apparent in the very low voter turnout in the 2018 elections. But the difficulty these protesters have faced has been knowing how to overcome the system peacefully without joining it.
So we must be careful not to view Iraqi politics only through the lens of religious sectarianism. For the Kurdish community, for example, their sense of national identity is often more important than their religious one.
It is misleading to see Iraqi politics purely in terms of religious sectarianism. And in fairness, I think that post-2003, Iraqi politics has always been seen through an ethno-sectarian lens as opposed to a purely sectarian one. And of course, ethnic nationalism is also a form of identity politics. So I said that roughly 65% of the Iraqi population are Shia, and nearly 35% are believed to be Sunni. But of those, around 17% of Iraqis are Kurds, and they are a mixture of Sunni and Shia. And in fact, for most Kurds, Kurdish nationalism weighs far more heavily in terms of political identity than sect. The leading Kurdish national parties in Iraq, the Kurdish Democratic Party and the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, were two of the opposition parties who took part in pre-regime change negotiations in exile over the future of the Iraqi state and the Iraqi government. And their claims were recognised in the post-2003 settlement. So on the one hand, the president is always Kurdish, and on the other hand, the Iraqi constitution of 2005 confirms Iraqi Kurdistan as a federally governed territory. Arguably, the Kurdish region in Iraq is just as affected by transactional political deal-making as the rest of the country. Also, I think it's worth noting that in terms of sectarian identity politics, it has never been so obvious at the subnational provincial level, where often tribal or other more parochial concerns have influenced political deal-making. And even at the national level, sectarian identity politics have lost some of their coherence over the last 17 years. In national elections, sect-based political blocs have progressively given way to cross-sectarian alliances. So in the 2018 elections, the number of alliances that were made between political factions, both before and after the election, is just massively complicated.
The Iraqi mass protests of 2019 are a good example of what we call on the conflict research programme civicness. They show how the logics of the marketplace and identity politics are not the only ones present in conflict zones. In fact, this is a tendency found across the whole of the Middle East.
The closest comparison is certainly with the protests that have been taking place in Lebanon over the last year, purely because of the sectarian nature of the political systems in both Lebanon and Iraq. And as I mentioned, in Lebanon, the consociational arrangement of Lebanese politics is much more formalized than it is in Iraq. But essentially, the same relationship between sectarian politics and the political marketplace, we can call it, or patronage politics, exists in both countries to the extent that it is very difficult to get away from that. Even looking for employment in the public sector, which is the most stable source of employment in both countries, and participating in everyday life or politics at any level, has become so dominated by sectarian issues that it's very difficult for young people to get away from that. In the Iraqi case, there have been a number of slogans that have come up. One of the, that sticks in my mind is Iraqis with banners saying, "No to Iran, no to America." And really, they're making the point that they've had enough of external interventions. And both Iran and the US continue to put enormous pressure on Iraq. And that's something that is unpalatable to the majority of young Iraqis, it would seem.
So these external deal makers in a political marketplace, aligned to particular forms of identity politics, run up against opposition from a young, civic-minded generation seeking a different form of political authority.
Part 3. Can development states turn into political marketplaces? A closer look at Ethiopia.
In episode 2, we explained how Ethiopia was often seen as an alternative to the political marketplace, a developmental state with strong institutionalization. And certainly its developmental track record has been good, but today Ethiopia is facing a range of pressures which threaten to create political marketplace conditions and underline the relationship of this type of authority to identity politics. The Ethiopian developmental state was a product of the end of the Cold War. In 1991, the Marxist-Leninist military junta was overthrown by a coalition of freedom fighters called the EPRDF.
As government troops surrendered and the rebels were unstoppable, the crumbling Marxist regime in Addis Ababa Palis.
Peace talks in London that year were brokered by the United States. At the time, the US was at a pinnacle moment of its global power as the Cold War was over and the Soviet Union was in its final stage of collapse. The talks reached a dramatic conclusion when the EPRDF took control of the capital Addis Ababa, prompting the United States to effectively end the talks taking place in London.
As I speak, a ceasefire is being announced in Addis Ababa by the interim government. In order to reduce uncertainties and eliminate tensions in the city, and after consulting with all of the parties, the United States government is recommending that the forces of the EPRDF enter the city as soon as possible to help stabilize the situation.
Mulugeta Berhe is a former Ethiopian freedom fighter and politician. He has been involved in Ethiopian politics since the 1970s. Today he is a senior fellow at Tufts University. He argues that the overwhelming victory of the EPRDF allowed for a smooth transition, and from the outset the new state developed a professional approach to administration.
Beginning from the transition, it was essentially a success story. And why did this happen so? One of the things I think is the level of stateness the EPRDF had while fighting during the war was very high. It acted like a state. People of the liberated areas that were meant to administer themselves. Therefore, there was this experience of stateness.
He recalls how national education exams scheduled for weeks after the EPRDF took power still took place, and the global expectation that Ethiopia would become another Somalia was confounded.
When the EPRDF was marching into Addis, everybody else, with the exception of the EPRDF, was expecting Ethiopia to be another Somalia, which at that time was already stateless, and where militia groups had their own sides fighting each other in Mogadishu and all over Somalia. So people didn't expect anything less than Somalia to happen in Ethiopia when the EPRDF was marching to Addis. Fortunately, it didn't end so. To the surprise of many people, there was more or less a smooth type of transition. The state continued to operate. The EPRDF marched to Addis on May 28, 1991. And 7 days after, it was a payday for pensioners, Ethiopian pensioners. It was a payday for Ethiopian civil servants. And the EPRDF made sure that pay for pensioners, pay for civil servants, are paid in due time. A month after it marched into Addis, it was the date for national exams, nationally administered exams, including the high school leaving certificate exam, the junior high school leaving national exam, all sorts of things. So either you miss that deadline or you pass it, you risk the chance of messing up with the academic calendar. And the EPRDF managed to run it in time.
Berhe argues that the intellectual orientation of the leadership was also a factor in creating the conditions for the successful construction of a developmental state after 1991.
And intellectualism. I mean, the leadership of the EPRDF used to engage deeply in it, updating itself modern thoughts, in constantly engaged in policy review, constantly engaged in updating itself, its policies, its strategies, and so on and so forth.
Ethiopia's track record in poverty reduction is impressive, with millions brought out of poverty over the last two decades. Although still a very poor country by global standards, Ethiopia confounded many expectations. Between 1990 and 2015, life expectancy, for example, increased by 17.5 years to just under 65. Berhe argues that it was only relatively recently, where the developmental state has started to fragment. He identifies a leadership model that was unable to effectively evolve, a contradiction between a constitution that called for decentralized power and a highly centralized party, the EPRDF.
On the one hand, you have a constitution that calls for decentralization of power. And therefore, it's assuming that the regional states do exercise their constitutional prerogatives independent of anybody, because there is a need for it, and that's a constitutionally enshrined one. On the other hand, you have a highly organized party that administers them as sort of its branch, where decisions come from the center. So, you know, four of the major regions, the Tigray region, the Amhara region, the Oromia region, the southern nations and nationalities, that essentially compose not less than 85% of the Ethiopian population, were run by coalition members of the EPRDF, who were organized as one entity from top to bottom.
As Ethiopia was a multi-ethnic state, this created tensions that always came with the risk of marketplace politics.
This form of administration, changing cultural identities into administrative structures, have its own risk. There is a possibility that it would be used in an exclusive form. You have to be innovative enough to capture historical change into the process and therefore make it evolve as an inclusive, right-to-purpose type of instrument. I think the EPRDF started failing here. And then elites of the coalition members started using ethnicism as an instrument for power, nationalism as an instrument for power.
The Ethiopian Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, came to power in 2018 amidst high hopes due to his commitment to ending the war with Eritrea.
A lot has happened and a lot of people have lost their lives. The new Prime Minister has to communicate and listen to people.
Ahmed's peacemaking led him to be granted the Nobel Peace Prize in 2019. But many believe the award to be premature in the context of mounting political and ethnic tensions, which saw 800,000 people displaced amidst intercommunal violence in the south of the country in 2018. Mounting civil unrest has also taken on an intercommunal dimension. Jawar Mohammed, the main opposition figure to Ahmed, describes himself as an Oromo nationalist, referring to the country's Oromo tribe. He has been accused of stoking intercommunal violence and tension. Ahmed is the first Ethiopian leader to come from the Oromo tribe, was at one time allied with Jawar Mohammed, but is now in a standoff against him. Mohammed now accuses Ahmed of authoritarianism.
He is resorting to the early signs of dictatorship, of trying to intimidate people, even with his very close allies, individuals who helped him come to power.
Meanwhile, a human rights report accused the Ethiopian state of killing hundreds of Oromo protesters. The Oromo people have historically faced discrimination and political marginalization. All of this creates a picture of a society on a trajectory towards intercommunal violence, identity politics, and the creation of a political marketplace state, and not, sadly, a developmental one. Alex DeWaal argues that Abiy Ahmed attracted attention from political marketplace operators within the region as his relative naivety made marketplace activity cheaper.
So one of the first responses to the veteran political market operators when they saw Abiy Ahmed elevated to become Prime Minister of Ethiopia was to think, aha, politics in Ethiopia is cheap. We have an experienced, somewhat naive operator there. We can move in and sweep up this market more cheaply.
We know from the cases we study on the conflict research programme that the transition towards violence can take place suddenly. To avoid these outcomes requires supporting civil society movements pursuing a different form of political authority to one based on political marketplace and identity politics. Ethiopia underlines how even successful developmental states can slide backwards towards marketplace-like politics. If they are highly centralized, without strong democratic mechanisms, as was the case in Ethiopia, then they can start to fragment when they face political opposition. Elites and factions may respond to this crisis by seeking legitimacy through ethnic identity and commercializing their relationship to politics.
Part 4. Identity politics and the civil war in Syria.
The Syrian conflict has been recognized internationally as involving a range of different forms of identity politics. It is a tragic example of an intractable conflict situation, with a bloody war which has been raging for nearly a decade. Each armed faction within the Syrian conflict and political marketplace has the patronage of different international actors and forces. And for the Assad regime that has clung on to power, the support of Vladimir Putin's Russia has been critical. Their military intervention in 2015 changed the course of the conflict.
Tearing into the night over the Caspian Sea, Russia's first naval barrage of its Syrian war, and the latest dramatic escalation in this conflict.
Syrian tanks and guns terrify Syrian people.
Vladimir Putin is being hailed as a hero for supporting President Assad.
Rim Turkmani is the research director of the Syrian Research Programme at the LSE. She explains the contradictions in the ruling ideology and political identity of the Assad regime.
In theory, the political ideology of the regime is dominated by the ideology of the Ba'ath Party. The Ba'ath Party, until 2012, was, in the constitution, the ruling party, the one and only party. Now, after 2012, they changed the constitution, so it's not the one and only party anymore, but still everything we see on the ground still tell us that it is the only ruling party. Now, the Ba'ath Party adopts what is meant to be socialist ideology and a strong Arab nationalist ideology, and it pretends to be very secular. Now, the reality is a little bit different, but on the Arab nationalism, they actually are very strong. They try to impose the Arab identity on all Syrians. And many Syrians don't identify with this. One very good example is the Syrian Kurds, who are clearly not Arabs, but still they were forced to kind of say they were Arabs. They were banned to learn their language, to teach their culture to their children, to even sing their songs.
Nominally speaking, Ba'athist ideology is socialist, but this bears no real relationship to either the economic or constitutional reality of Assad Syria. The confessional politics of religious sects is, however, critical.
It pretends to be secular and to separate religion from the state, but actually, in the constitution, it gives power to the sects to rule the personal affairs of the citizens. So any Syrian citizen, in relation to anything that have to do with their personal status, such as marriage, childcare, inheritance, all of this has to go through the rules of the sect they belong to, the religion and the sect, right? So we have about 18 personal status law in Syria. As a result, some of them, for example, if you want to marry across religion, often people have to change their religion to do that. Some laws, let's say about the age of marriage, inheritance, they're very, very unfair. And still, the regime insisted on them because this was part of its way to stay in power. It always manipulated social cleavages as a tool to maintain power. One of these cleavages is the sectarian one. Others are, for example, tribal or ethnic cleavages.
Importantly, this approach to Syrian governance has its origins in post-colonial state building in the Middle East.
In general, the construction of ethnic and religious political identities in the entire Middle East is considered a relatively modern phenomena that paralleling the construction of modern nation states in the Middle East. In different phases of the state building, the ruling elites and colonial powers even, they deliberately fostered and manipulated differences of identity as a method of divide and rule. Now, in the context of the totalitarian regime, like, you know, which already suffers from multiple crises, including crisis of legitimacy, which is the case of Syrian regime, you know, we've seen this even much more pronounced. So because the regime knows that it is completely illegitimate, its incapacity to address the problems and challenges that are coming from the society led him to even further manipulation of social cleavages.
The majority of Syrians are Arab Sunni Muslims, yet the regime is allied to the Syrian Shia theocracy, and it is often described as representing the Alawites, a sect within the Shia Muslim tradition. Rimturk Mani, however, warns against this assessment of the Syrian regime and argues that it needs significant qualification.
I wouldn't describe it as an Alawite regime itself, as in this regime doesn't necessarily protect the interest of the entire Alawite community. It doesn't represent them. It's certainly not religious in terms of like Alawite doctrine, but it does build on some of the fears that accumulated within that sect, which is a minority sect in Syria. And these fears have accumulated over centuries and centuries. They're not modern. I mean, they started almost 1,000 years ago in Iraq, when the sect was driven out of Iraq and Iraq into Syria. And they've been always marginalized and threatened. So there are historic fears inside. So it built on these fears to recruit some people from that sect to become the guardians of the regime. In reality, the regime have exploited the sects. Right now, many people from the Alawite sect will tell you, we lost an entire generation of our young men who fought in the side of this regime and died. So in reality, actually, they lost their children. Many of their villages in the coastal mountains of Syria are still extremely poor. And he wants to keep them poor, right? So that they keep feeling the kind of the need for him to be in power. And the regime continue to feed this notion that if I go, you will be threatened, you will be massacred. So I'm your guardian. Now, I don't think there will be massacres if the regime goes. There will be some issues, certainly, especially because of the last 10 years. But I think it all can be controlled. So the fears were certainly exaggerated, and not only from the Assad side. I mean, sadly, after the collapse within the Syrian state and the emergence of different ideology and populists from all sides, there are also populists from the opposition side who played on the sectarian fears and who started singing the song of Sunnis, you know, coming back and they're going to end the rule of Alawite. Geopolitics also played a role here. So the Gulf money, for example, arrived to support such a sectarian narrative in the opposition. The alliances with Turkey also influenced the narrative of the opposition and increased the ethnic and the sectarian cleavages. There is no clear political ideology right now for the regime. There is a remnant of what used to be the Ba'ath Party, and now it's mixed up with all kinds of things. There is no clear leading political ideological thoughts that the regime can use to lead its followers. It's only leading them now by fear and not by political ideology.
The rise of the Islamic fundamentalist movement ISIS in Syria was closely related to the development of the conflict in Iraq, where it made its initial gains. At the high point of its territorial power, in May 2015, it controlled huge swathes of land in eastern Syria, comprising 9 administrative regions, and recruited thousands of followers. It shot to global prominence due to its success and its willingness to use extreme violence and terror.
ISIS released a new video today showing the execution of 21 Coptic Christians kidnapped in Libya.
ISIS reveled in the violence, documenting each gruesome act.
Hands firmly behind their head, these Syrian soldiers know the horror that's about to unfold.
We came here to take over this place, inshallah, and put the Sharia and implement the Sharia.
Rimturk Mani argues the most distinctive elements of ISIS within the Syrian political marketplace was its state-building agenda. They pursued a geographical model based on absolute territorial power.
When it comes to ISIS, what is more important than their political ideology is their state-building mentality. And this is the main difference between ISIS, which in theory is still Al-Qaeda-associated group, same like other groups in Syria, like Jabhat al-Nusra, which is now known as Jabhat Fateh al-Sham. But ISIS differed that they wanted to build a state with a clear geographical borders. So they wanted to act as the absolute power holder in a particular geography. They don't want to share power, not in any way. So they presented a comprehensive model in every area they took over in Syria. And I don't think they would ever been able to kind of take over any area if there was no conflict in the first place. So there was a conflict that led to collapse of state in many areas. And then they built on this. They go on to these areas. They found a complete mess. Yeah, no system of governance, war economy at play, many people in need of a job. There's chaos, there's crime. So they come in and they say, all right, we are the state right now. We're going to reverse that collapse and we're going to impose a comprehensive system. With this comes the ideology, but also everything else. So that includes their police, for example, their own courts. And then here the police answers to these courts, which then answers to their ideological top figures. And then there's kind of pseudo army. Everything was very comprehensive, the Al-Qaeda. So they wanted to pretend they are a state. This was not the case of many others. So for example, with the, if you compare it with the other Al-Qaeda associated group in Syria, like Jabhat al-Nusra, they were rarely able to impose such overall control on a certain geography and to be the only power in play. Yeah. So for ISIS, they don't accept anyone else. So no local councils, no civil society, you know, it was only them.
This makes ISIS somewhat unusual in a political marketplace context. They pursued a form of absolute government control, which grew out of the extreme dislocation of the Syrian economy.
The state of the economy helped them a lot because, as I said, there were so many young men out there desperately need a job, desperately need an income. And they were able to pay many of them to recruit them within their circles, and not necessarily to go and kill people, but sometimes just to be part of their police that surveys the towns and villages, make sure that no one is smoking, no woman is going unveiled. They also had their own contracts with the tribes in the area as well. There are certain deals with each tribe. So they negotiated with the tribe leaders and give them some access to some resources. They helped reviving the agriculture in their villages. For example, if the water system is broken down, they will fix all the water pumps so that they can farm their lands and so forth. So they gave something to everyone to buy loyalty. And that was one of their key methods. Now, the money wasn't all made inside Syria. They received lots of money from outside. And they also traded on antiquity. I mean, Syria, it's just full of antiquities everywhere, right? So while they actually may stage something like blowing up the Baal temple in Palmyra, but actually in reality, they were selling what was left in the Palmyra Museum. They were selling it in the international market.
These financial resources made them an important player in the political marketplace.
They used all this money to buy loyalty, to enforce their position, to even have deals with the powers in the area surrounding them, including the regime, by the way, including the opposition. So they would have a deal, for example, with the regime on the exchange of wheat. Let's say the wheat was produced in some of the areas they controlled. They will allow it to go to the regime area being sold there, but in return for part of that wheat. Same thing for the oil and many other resources. So I would say it's both the collapse of the state and the war economy that enabled ISIS to be such a big thing. And on top of that, of course, there was the ideological vacuum in Syria. I mean, as the state collapsed and most people were not genuinely convinced with the ideology of the Ba'ath Party, so there was this vacuum out there that needed to be filled, and they exploited that and they recruited people to their ideology.
So we see important elements of a political marketplace context: identity politics, the militarization of grievances through armed struggle, the exploitation, of financial resources, external patronage, and deal making.
Conclusion. What works? Overcoming identity politics and the political marketplace.
Globalization is an era of world capitalism that we discussed in episode 2. We noted how financial liberalization was an important factor in fueling conflict, and indeed, it is generally discussed as a process that moves from the global north or the west to the global south. But suffice to say, it's as always more complicated than that. Global development is incredibly interconnected, and connections and causes run in multiple directions. Indeed, Alex DeWaal argues we may, with the Trump administration, be seeing a globalization of political marketplace conditions.
Speaking from the United States, it's very striking that the same logic of the marketization of politics with which we became very familiar in countries like Sudan and Congo and Kenya is also proceeding apace in the United States, both in its domestic politics and in the way in which the Trump administration conducts its international relations. I mean, Trump emerged from a business environment in which he was dealing with the most advanced form of the political marketplace in the developed world, which was Russia. He was a sort of minor actor, a small-time gangster, if you like, in Russia's casino politics. He was bought off really pretty cheaply by the Russian operators and considered a fairly naive small-time operator. Now he's in a position where he can transplant exactly those same principles to the world stage. And it's striking that the much more skilled and experienced political marketplace operators of the Middle East have been able to play the Trump administration to their advantage over the last few years. And the kleptocrats, autocrats, and mercenaries of the greater Middle East and the Horn of Africa feel very at home in the way that the current White House is conducting its business.
Overcoming these dynamics is challenging within states themselves, but it becomes even harder when the logics are globalized. In most of our research, we find that external interventions by international actors tend to be subverted by the dominant logics of the political marketplace and identity politics. But these risks can be reduced if they are properly understood. External interventions are only likely to work if they address the underlying social condition that is producing the violence. They need to open up a space for a shift in that logic. Concretely, this means that they should weaken and seek to weaken the dominant logics of the political marketplace and identity politics. They should identify moments of contradiction in those logics where change might become possible. And furthermore, they should nurture existing or potential pockets of civicness. Conflict analysis often seek to identify spoilers, instances, events, or actors that can wreck preconceived plans. But they should also pay attention to those who perform the opposite function. Citizens, activists, professionals, and office holders at all levels, from local to international, who find creative ways to broker agreements, contest sectarian cleavages, or extremist ideologies, resist corruption, and open up spaces for non-violent deliberation. In the next episode, we explore this phenomenon of civicness, which we have encountered in societies experiencing conflict. It encompasses a whole range of individuals and groups working within societies for a better public authority. For now, that concludes today's podcast on the concept of the political marketplace. We hope you found it informative and educational. You can find more information on the Conflict Research Programme at the LSE website. Just put LSE Conflict Research Programme into your search engine and it will come up. You can find details on the site of upcoming events, videos of previous ones, and links to all of our publications. You can also follow us on Twitter @LSE_CCS. See you next time.